Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Why don't we start with unschooling? How do you feel about that term?
Well, I feel uncomfortable in general because unschooling, especially in the last 15 years, has gone through this weird phase where you go to a conference and people would say, "What do you mean by unschooling?"
Right.
And that always bothered me. It's like, wait, for me, it was very simple because, and it still is. All right. I understand why people, definitions change, no doubt, but the original definition of unschooling is one I always go with, and that is what John Holt wrote, which is unschooling is, he preferred the word over homeschooling because it refers to learning that doesn't have to take place at home, and it doesn't have to look like school. Simple, plain, straightforward, and does make a distinction between school and what he's proposing. But it's gotten so confused because then it gets into this thing. And I remember going through this with the National Coalition of Alternative Community Schools in the mid-80s when they were getting more and more accepting of homeschoolers. But they had this whole issue of coercion, you know?
Yeah.
And, I don't know. I mean, you know, parents could be much more coercive than alternative educators. And I was like, I don't know about that. And then everyone gets, you know, this whole idea of coercion then became like, you know, are you coercing your child because, you know, you're asking them to stay here while you go to the bathroom?
You know, right.
It became these really weird thought experiments, or sometimes are actual incidents. And I was like, okay, but, you know, I don't mind that, you know, I think we have to have the big tent of unschooling, or in homeschooling is probably the word, because even John Holt stopped using the word unschooling when he just realized that, just like he gave up, didn't give up, but said he changed tack. And when children's rights didn't work, it didn't mean he didn't think children shouldn't have rights anymore. He says, I'm just ahead of the curve here. These people are not, it's not getting traction. What will get traction? His next book was Freedom and Beyond, where he tried the alternative schools. But he even talked himself out of that by the end of that book. So he said, it's still not enough. You know, alternative schools are still soft jails instead of hard jails, but they're not what I'm talking about. And then instead of education, he called for the Underground Railroad to get children out of compulsory schools. And that's where he learned about homeschooling, and a year later started Growing Without Schooling. And then the word homeschooling bothered him so much, he came up with the word unschooling.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is November 14th, and this is the 633rd time I have posted a podcast into this RSS feed. It is unbelievable, borderline unacceptable, that this is the first one ever to include Pat Ferenga. At this point, many of you are probably already familiar with his work. He ran the Growing Without Schooling magazine, started by John Holt, from the time John died in the mid-80s until the year 2001. He is also the author of The Beginner's Guide to Homeschooling, published in 1998, and teacher-owned the John Holt Book of Homeschooling, published in 2003. Pat has been a central figure in the promotion of unschooling and alternative education and the explanation of those things since the 1980s. He has an absolutely incredible story that we barely scratched the surface of today, but I did at the end of this conversation invite him back on the show in the near future. I really enjoy every interview with Pat that I have heard. It always makes me happy to listen to him, and I think unless you are a real Grinch, you're going to have a similar experience with this podcast. So I'm really happy to be bringing it to you today. Pat was at one time an aspiring school teacher, but then in the early 1980s, he encountered the ideas of John Holt, when he encountered a man named John Holt who said, "You're interested in being a teacher? Well, first, I'd like to tell you about some ideas I have." I am paraphrasing, but Pat will tell you that story in the show today. He worked closely with John Holt, with Ivan Ilyich, who brought us the concept of deschooling. He was friends with John Taylor Gatto. We're going to talk about that right at the beginning of the show. And he also offers a lot of wisdom through his own story of unschooling. He has three adult children who were all unschooled through most of their education. That's going to be a big portion of our discussion today as well. Please remember that this is a listener-supported project. There are many ways to offer your support. So many ways, in fact, that I am very confident there is one that is just perfect for you. The two that I recommend, schoolsucksproject.com/AV. You can join the AV Club. That's a bonus content club. Is it really a club, Brett? Yes, because once you join the AV Club, you can also request membership in the Friends of the SSP Facebook group. And the other option is Patreon, patreon.com/schoolsucks. Thank you so much to the people who do that. You are the reason this show exists. All right. Without further ado, here is my absolutely delightful conversation and hopefully the first of many with Pat Ferenga. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brett. Pleasure to be here.
I'm very, very excited. This is long overdue. I feel like there's so many things that we can talk about today. I wanted to start, though, before we get into your story. You know, I was doing a roundtable yesterday on the life and the legacy of John Taylor Gatto. As you know, he passed away last month. And I know you guys crossed paths several times, probably in the last couple decades. And I was just interested in your thoughts on his work, his impact, how it affected you, and how you think he affected the larger conversation about not just schooling, but alternative learning.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think the well, first of all, John and I were friends. I mean, we knew each other since 1991, and I had him speak at three or four conferences that I put on with Growing Without Schooling in the 90s. And one in, I think it was 2003, the Learning in Our Own Way conference was, where he delivered his, Weapons of Mass Instruction, talk. And, then we started to lose touch, as he had strokes and whatnot. And, although I tried to stay in touch with him as best I could then, but, you know, we also were invited often to speak at the same conference. For instance, we spoke at a conference in Toronto, and we wound up sharing a room. Another one in San Bernardino, another time in London. And every time we've had those opportunities, we always wound up finding some place to have a few drinks and talk for a few hours. And he was a great guy. I mean, what everyone thinks about John Gatto is, you know, his explosive rhetoric and his knocking of schools and stuff. But I have all these memories of him also talking about movies, talking about books, talking about politics. I mean, you know, education, you know, while we did talk about it, it was only one of the topics. You know, it wasn't like the only thing we ever talked about. And I think that's why we were friends, because, you know, he had so many other interests, you know, besides education, as do I, you know. So we share that. And we laughed a lot. I mean, John was a very funny guy. I mean, he could be sarcastic as anything, but he also had a natural wit, you know, and so we always enjoyed each other's company. And to try and put it in perspective, John Holt passed away in 1983 or 84. I always get that confused. But until then, and then after he passed away, like pseudo friends like Herb Cole or Jonathan Kozol would like say, "Oh, well, John was an okay guy and stuff, but he's got these crazy ideas about homeschooling," and they never got on board with it, and no one except Ivan Ilyich and his friends, the Flying Circus of Ilyich, as he like to call it,
right?
They got it, you know, and that was it. But then, you know, Ilyich was in Germany for 6 months of the year, then at Penn State another few months of the year. He traveled all over the place, so he wasn't someone that I myself or anyone had a chance to really talk with at length, except when he was available. And then and then out of the blue in 1991, someone contacted me and said, did you see this speech that the teacher of the year gave when he took his award? He called the school psychopathic. And he suggested that people homeschool if the schools don't get better. And I was like, you're kidding me. Now, we didn't have the internet like we do now. So, you know, it took me a while to find this speech. It was called The Psychopathic School. It was his acceptance speech for the New York City Teacher of the Year Award. And after I read it, I called him up, introduced myself, and he knew a little bit about John Holt. He was familiar with him. And next thing you know, he was speaking at a conference that I was putting on that later that year. And then he invited me to speak at his conference, this event that he called the first national grassroots speak out on school choice. Mm. And he rented Carnegie Hall for that.
Oh, wow.
And, I spoke at Carnegie Hall. It was an incredible experience. You know, I was in a dressing room and I fantasized that the practice piano there was the one used by Dave Brubeck when they recorded Take Five at Carnegie Hall. It was quite a moment. And John, you know, stage managed that whole thing. And it was this wide group of people. I mean, the Sudbury Valley Schools, the Albany Free School, a bunch of his students. I represented homeschooling. It was a real open – and the book that he produced from that has all those talks in there. And, you know, all the work that John did with kids in school also is what attracted us as homeschoolers. I mean, John was giving homeschooling a validation that it hadn't had since John Holt passed away, because most professionals – educators are like, oh, homeschooling.
Right. Know? Yeah.
You know? But John didn't have that reservation because he understood that, you know, parents have the right to do this and why not exercise it? And he enjoyed seeing people do that. And that was a real shot in the arm. And then when you hear that, what John Gatto actually told me, in fact, I'm sure he said this in public, what he did in his classes was a tortured version of homeschooling. Because you know, yes. He had to run all this interference to get the kids out of the class so they could do interesting things like sell their sweaters on the sidewalks of New York. And where one of them, he got an internship at Marvel Comics and so on, you know?
But, it's interesting, you know, too. It's like, you know, you talk about him being just familiar with John on the surface. And you know, one of John Holt's recommendations was get kids out in the real world. And that's what he was actually doing. I mean, a lot of us who are younger, we first encounter Gatto anyway through some of his more provocative writing and criticism of the school and this revelatory history of the school and all the people who tried to – the interests that tried to shape public schooling through the 20th century. But then, like, if our curiosity is piqued and we dig a little bit deeper and we find there's this great television special. I was talking about this yesterday, Classrooms of the Heart. Where it basically shows him, it's a local television piece, maybe 25 minutes long, basically shows him, it's a couple months before he resigned too, so it's really, you can see where this is going. He's sneaking kids out of the school to get them out into the real world, right? So that tortured version of unschooling, I think that's mm-hmm. what you refer to it as.
Yep.
Yeah, you can really, really see it in this video, but it wasn't, I think it was like a couple of years into looking into his work before I found that. And I got to see what, okay, this is what learning is. You know, this is like, he talks about, you know, how schooling isn't learning for so many people in so many ways, but to actually see what his conception of it was and to see it in action was a pretty amazing thing.
That's right. That's right. And John was also, like John Holt, an advocate for children, but for different reasons, I think. But one of the stories that – and I'm pretty sure John Gatto put this in a book towards the end of his life. But he talked about pulling the fire alarm to prevent the kids from having to take a state exam one time because he knew none of the kids were going to pass. None of them were prepared.
Right, right, right. So it was really an honor for me yesterday to be asked to be a part of this roundtable that was facilitated – by a college history professor who has a podcast, and he's down in Florida. And he asked me and this historian named Richard Grove to talk about, you know, John Gatto's work. Richard Grove actually produced a documentary in 2011 called The Ultimate History Lesson, where he talks to John just very stream of consciousness. Like, so you talk about the adventure of conversing with John. Yes. Rich would just ask these very, you know, simple, not pointed questions, and they would open up into this amazing world of discovery. Like the depth of John's knowledge about so many things and the connections that he could make just, you know, prompted. I mean, I think Rich had like a 50-page outline for this interview that he wanted to do. I don't know if they knew it was going to be 6 hours long, like a 6-hour hour documentary film. But anyway, so the three of us are talking about this yesterday, and one of the reasons why I was honored to be involved is this professor, C.J. Kilmer, saw us doing work that helps push John's message into the future. So that meant a lot to me to be included in something like that, this idea of carrying on important work. And the timing of our conversation is interesting because while you have a really interesting and inspiring story of your own, and we're going to talk about it today, you also took on a similar pursuit on a much grander scale, I think, than I have with the work of John Holt. So I wanted to talk to you about your own unschooling story. You have three girls. I think they're all like from 20 to mid-20s at this point.
Oh, no. The oldest is 31.
31.
Yeah, 31, 28, and 26.
Okay. I found a video where it said their ages, but the video was 2015. So I just I added 3 years to all of their ages, but I guess that video was outdated information,
or
too.
Or my memory right now is wrong. I know the 26. We just celebrated her birthday in October, so she is 26. I know that.
So I really want to ask you a very, very open-ended question that's going to talk about, you know, John Holt's influence on you and how, you know, even though you're well-known as an unschooling advocate and all three of your adult children were mostly unschooled, even though you've talked about like the door to school was open if they wanted to walk through it. And of course, if right. they wanted to walk back out of it, but you really embrace this with your children. But there was a time in the early 1980s where you were reading a new book by John Holt called Teach Your Own and saying, this is crazy. So what I'm interested in, and you can take as much time with this as you want. My audience will love the answer. What happened before that moment where you're sitting there with that book in your hand? And how did you go from that moment of thinking this was crazy to eventually embrace this? Wow, this is a huge question, but to eventually embracing those ideas with your own children.
All right. Yeah. When I started work at Holt Associates, I was a volunteer. I volunteered there to learn word processing, which was a whole separate machine in those days.
Right.
Whole another skill. And needless to say, I graduated college with a master's in English, and they never talked about things like word processing or, you know, how to edit, you know, people's work other than what you see in a teacher do to your papers.
Right.
So I thought this would be a good way to get in the publishing business. And John was actually on a 3-month tour of Scandinavia at that time. And so I never met the man, you know, and I saw at that point, and I was reading the magazine, looking at this stuff, just saying, well, I'm just here to learn word processing. And then when he came back, you know, he asked me who I was and whatnot. We met. And it turned out that he was born in Manhattan. We shared this love of jazz. We were talking about music. It was a lovely conversation. And then he asked me, what do I want to do? You know, and I said, well, I want to be a teacher. And I hadn't read anything of his yet. And he just looked at me and he said, why? And I said, because I like working with children. And John took his eyeglasses off, looked me right in the eye and said, oh, Pat, you got it all wrong. If you become a teacher, you're not going to work with children, you're going to work on children.
Yeah.
And I was offended. I was like, that's not what teachers do. Oh, you know, I did what I've experienced so many times in my own life since John passed away. It's just like people just get hurt when you suggest that there are other ways to teach other than sit down, shut up, and do as I say.
And you're like your early 20s at this point when you're having this interaction?
That's right. I was a single man. I just moved from New York to Boston to be near my girlfriend, who's now near my wife. And yeah, and I couldn't get a teaching job because the property rollback tax bill had passed here in 1981. And so they were firing teachers instead of hiring them. And so I really, you know, got a good feeling of like the, you know, how the cycles of funding for education go too.
But you had some emotional investment when you come in contact with these ideas. You already have some emotional investment in the idea of becoming a teacher yourself.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me in hindsight because I always go back to my high school experience, you know, for the reason I want to be a teacher. And it turned out that I was in like the sweet spot for my school. It was called Fordham Prep. It's in the Bronx. And it was a very conventional Jesuit high school. But during the period I was there in the early 1971 to 75, they were experimenting and they had an open school. And so I got a taste of what it was like to choose your own curriculum and stuff. It wasn't nearly as free as unschooling, but it was certainly an awful lot freer than anything I'd experienced before then or since, you know, because college was much more rigid than that. They say, yeah, you could pick a few courses, but, you know, you got to make sure they all line up for the right credits. This was more like, oh, you're interested in nuclear power? We'll figure out a way to help you work with nuclear power. So I kind of had that, you know. But already by the time I was a senior, they were cutting back on that. It was too many parents were saying the kids were not really learning, you know.
Right, right.
You know, so this, the standard thing was no one has the patience. Everyone wants, you know, I taught you this on Monday. You should know it today, you know, right. Tuesday. You know, so I was kind of primed for these ideas, but they still didn't make sense to me. And I said everything to John, like, well, how are they going to get into college? And he just pulled back and said, have you read any of my books? No. And he said, well, please do, you know, try, you know, and then we'll talk about it. He says, I'm not going to just start from scratch. And he did that throughout his life. When he was asked to speak at universities or homeschooling groups and stuff, he always asked him, are you familiar with any of my work? Have you read any Ivan Illich? You would take that as two. If you'd read Deschooling Society, okay, at least we have a common spot to start, you know, because he was, you know, these are hard conversations to have even today, you know, because people just think, oh, you just want to blow up the schools.
You know, oh, sure. Yeah. And I think that by the time you encountered John Holt, like most of his writing was already done. I think he only wrote two books after that. Right. So if you're right. Talking about, you know, you're working on Teach Your Own. Yeah. The evolution of his work was pretty visible by then. Yes. But that's probably a tough first encounter with his ideas. Right. If you don't
that's
know
right.
his story of where he's coming from.
That's right. And that's why when and I was literally unpacking the hardcover copies of Teach Your Own in the office, I grabbed one and I couldn't understand. It just didn't make sense to me. So I remember saying to the office manager at the time, Peggy Durkee, what should I do? I mean, I'm really having trouble getting my head around these ideas. And she said, read his first book, How Children Fail. Mm-hmm. Everything starts there, she said. And she was right. You know, and then, you know, before John passed away, he revised his first two books, How Children Fail and How Children Learn. They've both been in print continuously since they came out. In fact, How Children Learn celebrated its 50th year in print in 2018. And it's really, you know, interesting to me how once I started reading How Children Fail and he was talking about being a teacher and how he's going to respond to the students – then I understood better what he was getting into about self-directed learning and how too much teaching becomes poison to curiosity. He said, you know, teaching is like medicine. It should be only used in the right dose at the right time. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, it becomes poison. It's
too absolutely.
Much.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if you have – what was one of the things that he said a lot of the educational establishment hated? He kind of broke down this idea that – learning was the result of instruction, right?
That's right.
And he said learning was the result of the activity of the learner.
Exactly.
You know, I still have all these 3x5 index cards scattered all over my desk from yesterday. And I have one here about, since we were talking about Gatto, when he gave, right around the time that you first met him in 1991, he wrote that op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, I quit, I think, you know? And he said something in there like, oh, I have the card right here. Professional interest is served by making what is easy to do seem hard. He says in that letter that Socrates warned if teaching becomes a profession, you know, it will protect itself. Most of the energy will be used to protect the institution of the profession. So I think that it's obvious that Holt would have been perceived as a real threat to try to introduce this idea as a former teacher saying, you know, what I learned is that this isn't about putting kids in a room and making them do things. The prerequisite for learning, like teaching can be helpful and teaching can be great, and I'm glad to be a teacher. But if that prerequisite of intrinsic motivation isn't there, we're kind of useless and we need to admit that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing, you know, flesh out that idea about education, Illich pointed out, and this was, you know, in Deschooling Society, that book really changed John Holt's thinking a lot about education, because he was a conventional reformer up in, you know, testifying before Congress, organizing, you know, being in all the protest marches and stuff. And then when he, you know, Illich made the point, you know, I mean, you know, John Gatto made the point that education protects itself. Which is true, because there's certainly a, I mean, my gosh, I mean, it's a $1 billion industry. I read, you know, I subscribe to Education Week, and I'm amazed at how much advertising is in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has very little to do with, you know, with the actual effort of teaching. It just seems like, you know, here's your choices of what to purchase. You know?
Right, right.
And so, you know, Illich made the point, the need for education feeds upon itself. It never ends now. You know, and so, yeah, a BA, I mean, and we know this because when I was growing up, a high school degree was considered fine for finding work, but there was already this thing, no, you got to go to college. You know, it's not really that good anymore. Mm-hmm. And now everyone is saying a BA isn't good enough, you know, that we need to go for postgraduate school and for, you know, mandatory continuing education. If, you know, my God, I hope that never happens, but I could easily see it.
Yeah. So it's happening on this grand scale, but it's also happening on a smaller scale as well, where it's like, you know, people look at the failure of the school and they go, are the kids outside too much? Is that the problem? Is like two recesses too many? Like, you know, we had recess when I was in school. I was horrified to learn that my nieces and nephews don't. What if we made the school year longer? What if we made the school day longer? So, yes, even though it's talking about piling higher and higher levels of education on as necessary, it's also like the amount of time, right? There needs to be more and more of the only possibility for a solution is more and more of this, right?
Yeah. And you know, Brett, exactly like you're saying, and we've extended the years to 2.5 now they're pushing.
Yeah,
there's an article in today's Education Week about should we give kindergartners homework? Like, gosh, when does this pressure end? It starts earlier and earlier, and it's extending. They really want to push it beyond 16, you know, to 18 or 21, you know. And it's just like, whatever happened to the idea that we live and learn? That,
yes,
you know, that it's part and parcel of our existence. We've completely taken the idea of education and turned it into a commodity that has to be purchased and you know, throughout our lives, you know, and you know, I don't mind paying for classes and stuff that I'm interested in.
Sure.
But like all this mandatory stuff, like, you know, and we all know, I mean, and this is one of the great things that Holt always wrote about. You give the people a test on Friday, you know, they know the test was coming on Friday. They'll pass it. Give them the same test on Monday. Most of them will fail. You know, we know this. I mean, look at Princeton Review and all those SAT prep courses. That's what they're doing. Everyone forgets everything they learned after the test is over. You know, it just becomes a charade of learning, which Holt wrote in 1964 about his classes in private schools.
Well, this was my, you know, you mentioned Princeton Review. I mean, some of the most educational years of my life was doing that work as a tutor, right? When I left classroom teaching, I went to, you know, your area, Greater Boston. I spent, you know, pretty much, it's also ironic that this is kind of like the birthplace of public school. I remember coming across a statue of Horace Mann when I was going to meet some student one day in maybe like Dedham, Massachusetts or somewhere down there. But I was in the Needham area a lot, right? I remember teaching these SAT classes and these kids were like AP level, honors, Ivy League bound. Mm-hmm. I remember I had this group one day. And a kid got mad at me. I've told this story on my show before. He wasn't mad at me. He was frustrated and he kind of yelled at me about it.
Yeah.
We were going through some of the higher level SAT math questions. And it was like this multi-step problem, you know, and I would say to the kids, I'd say, look, this is just critical thinking, right? Like the mathematical operation that you might need for the hardest question on the SAT math section could be addition. The problem is you have to figure out that that's the operation you need to use. And there was this multi-step problem that required like, you know, some like different concepts kind of blended together. And the kid goes, no one ever gave me a formula for how to do a problem like this, you know? And I said, exactly. I said, exactly. I started to actually see the SAT as a kind of opportunity to strengthen critical thinking skills that school had left underdeveloped.
Right.
But I eventually also, just to speak to what you're saying, became frustrated with that work because I felt like I was enforcing expectations that weren't the best for everybody. You know, like you're done with 12th grade, time for 13th grade. You know, pull out 40 grand and get into 13th grade. Doesn't matter if you know what you want to do or not. So I was not inviting people to question this process. I was just like, this is, you know, you, it's granted that this is what you do next. I'm here to help you do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But please go on with the story. That just made me remember that experience.
Where were we?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we were talking about John Holt's impact on you as you get married, have children of your own, and how you go from, you know, being kind of standoffish about, or at least incredulous about these ideas, to right. your embrace of these ideas. And we're in the right. middle of that process, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And so when I was working with John, one of the things that he wanted to do was have an open house every month. So homeschoolers can come and meet him and talk. Mm-hmm. And then he hoped also just meet with one another. In fact, it became popular, and there were times when John was speaking and wasn't there, but he insisted that we still have these open houses. And I remember, you know, the first few I went to were a little dicey for me. It was like, oh, what are these people going to be like? Who are they? Because I met a few homeschoolers when they come to visit the office and stuff and their children. And that was always a pleasant, you know, short thing. But I wasn't sure what it was going to be like for 2 hours standing around in the office talking with folks. And it proved to be one of the most fascinating, you know, times of my life, because I was having like apple pickers come down and preachers, environmentalists, all sorts of people who wanted a homeschool as their issues were not being dealt with in school, and their children were suffering. They weren't happy, and they were looking for alternatives. And they didn't care that John was an atheist. They didn't care that we were not a political organization. You know, we were just trying to help people get their kids out. John's general idea, which he said in an interview on the BBC years ago, but always I always thought it was a good summary of his work. He says he felt that his mission in life was to figure out how to reintegrate children back into adult society.
Mm-hmm.
And once, you know, and that was a later revelation for him, was he thought it was fixing the schools.
Yeah.
And then he eventually realized it's a bigger problem, and that the schools can't get fixed until we come around to respecting children's abilities to learn. And, you know, that's, you know, there's a vested interest, as John Gatto points out, in making sure that, you know, we treat children as if they can't learn unless they had these professional ministrations.
So it was early on in John Holt's career where he was using the Underground Railroad phrase for
– No, that wasn't that until was later? 1976. Yeah, in his book, the year before he founded Grown Without Schooling magazine.
Mm-hmm.
See, he was looking around. How do we reintegrate children? So he thought, give them children's rights. That didn't fly. So he didn't give up after he wrote that book, Escape from Childhood, The Needs and Rights of Children, where he explores, like, if we gave them the exact same rights, nothing new, just what adults already enjoy, what would it be like? Boy, that book infuriates liberals and conservatives to this day.
I've heard you say, because you're in charge of the publishing of these books today.
Right.
And you've said that just about anything that he's written, a publisher will say, yes, of course, John Holt. Yes, well-respected name in alternative education. Let's publish it. But nobody wants to go near Escape from Childhood.
No one. And that's why I publish it.
Let's just tangent into that for a minute, because it's interesting. You know Mike Mayles? You ever come across his work?
I recognize the name. Who is he?
He's a sociologist, and he's been at work at least since the mid-90s on this very the idea. What's it? Phoebophobia, I think, is the word. The fear of children. Fear of teenagers, I think that might be specifically that. But he wrote a book in 1996 when I was finishing up high school called The Scapegoat Generation, America's War on Adolescence.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of his work is sounding the alarm on the pathologizing, and then through things like zero tolerance, the criminalizing of youth behavior, right? So zero tolerance was new when I was finishing high school. You know, we've had 20 years of it now. This idea, I think, is what John was addressing indirectly, and maybe not calling it by name. But if you think about – if you just think about the idea, it's like present through at least all of American history. You know, it's present in the Puritan life, where curiosity of children could be a threat, like the sense of adventure or the need for enlightenment is a threat to, the maintenance of that society. It appears again in the Industrial Revolution, I think, as a way to funnel children into the workplace to give them order and structure. But then once, you know, they don't need child labor anymore, it's like, well, we got to get these kids out of this place. They shouldn't be in here because they're not safe here. You know, like,
right.
Not that this is an unsafe place for them. It's like, you know how kids are. We can't rely on them to do this kind of work. But then in the 1990s, you know, the influence of rap music, youth crime, and then once you have an event like Columbine, that seems to be a confirmation of all of this pathologizing of youth behavior and the need to criminalize youth behavior. So this fear of children is always present, but for a variety of reasons. And it seems like it's almost like a politically useful tool, right? It can be inserted into different kinds of projects just based on the subtlety of its existence all through our history.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
Maybe that's what, you know, the pushback about Escape from Childhood was really about, or yeah. Part of it.
I think you're right. It's part of it. It's interesting. I mean, specifically, the comments that I keep hearing the most against that book is John's, that children should have the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that infuriates people when you bring that up. Even friends of mine who are diehard unschoolers, I'm surprised. Some of them just, they don't want to go there. Why, I can't see a child having that level of competence, you know, which is interesting, you know. So there's that. But you know, I just came out. In fact, this is the proof copy of GWI's Volume 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got up to I think this goes to 1984. But I found in here in one of the issues, I found a wonderful quote about school from John that is only in here. So I want to read this out to you. I put it on the back cover. A school is not an ideal. It is a social response to a difficult and wrong situation. A society which has no room and no use for children, and which has few people who are glad or even willing to have them around. The ideal would be a society in which knowledge was widely available and freely shared, and in which children were everywhere safe and welcome.
Mm.
I mean, he always had a nice, plain, straightforward way of describing the situation, you know?
Right.
And so that's what I try to do in my work, is to keep it as plain and keep, you know, I mean, everyone's got their reasons for doing it, you know, but you can always help them with the practicalities of it, regardless of whether you agree with their reasons, you know. And that's why I think that unschooling has been growing over the years, you know, as people are realizing it's very adaptable. It doesn't require you to buy into any particular, you know, Montessori, Waldorf, type of theory of education. It's like you work with your child. Well, you watch your child, and then you go where they're leading and keep them safe and provide advice as and comfort as you need. And, you know, yeah, sometimes they wind up in Waldorf or Montessori schools because that makes sense to them, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, or they use those methods at home is really what I meant to say.
Well, I've heard you talk about unschooling being having the best prospects for scalability, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like in these other alternative school models, there's probably limited scalability. Like they tried to scale Summerhill, they're still trying to scale Sudbury. There's other things that have come up more recently, like North Star. But if we, and maybe it's not the best way to think about it, but if you think about it as competitors to the public school system, first of all, that's endlessly scalable. Because if somebody owns a house, they're paying for it, right? So there's always money coming in. And, you know, it's also backed up by law. So the schools don't have a problem raising money to expand, the public schools. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, again, referencing something else you said, I think you called school the religion of the proletariat, right? Where there's
– I don't recall that one, but
– Yeah, I think you might have said it. My God. I'm glad you were here to correct the misquote if I made one. Yeah. But the idea was I think this was in the documentary what was the documentary called? Six years ago.
The War on Kids?
No. This was just five – the War on Kids was around the same time. I think it was called Class Dismissed.
Oh, Class Dismissed. Yes, yes.
And the idea you were presenting, even if I am misquoting you, was that people believe in school as a kind of salvation, right? Well,
yes.
Just get an education. Get this thing called an education, and that's the key. So you might have been saying it tongue-in-cheek,
yeah.
But it was the idea, the widespread public idea that there's salvation in education, and education is synonymous with going into one of these buildings for however long it takes to come out with, you know, some kind of documentation that says you were educated.
Right.
So that pretty much relieves all scalability problems, right? Endless right. money and this belief that this is right. a salvation. So it's hard now, to compete
on the
with
the salvation
that.
Thing. I'm trying to, you know, the proletariat, that's usually not a word I use.
So I don't think so. Right.
But, you know, but I do often say, because it's a striking quote from Illich, that, you know, schools claim to do what God cannot do, namely manipulate others for their own salvation.
Tell me a little bit more about what you think he meant or why he said that.
I think what Illich is getting at is that schools convince us that we can only be made full, made employable, or be saved by going through them. Mm-hmm. You know, we certainly see that a mind is a terrible thing to waste, right?
I mean,
that means you got to go to school, otherwise you're wasting your mind. You know, so that's how I interpret that.
So. Let's actually use that as a transition into talking about your own family and your own unschooling experience as a parent. Because one of the things that, you know, I talked to Sandra Dodd, do you know who she is? She was on my show recently.
Yeah.
I almost named the episode Stop Telling – now, my website is called School Sucks Project, and it's called that for a reason. But I almost named the episode with Sandra Stop Telling Young People That School Sucks, right? This idea of making school a kind of enemy – in the minds of children, or making school this forbidden place. So you're raising children through the 1990s, correctly, yeah. in Massachusetts. And you're in a place, as I remember, like I grew up in New Hampshire and I worked a lot in that area as a teacher and a tutor. Not a lot of homeschooling going on there, right? It could be initially fairly isolating. Maybe it changed over the course of their childhoods. Mm-hmm. But initially, I know you said that you were pretty much the only people in your area who were doing this. Mm-hmm. Now, kids couldn't be isolated from peers who went to school. So your children are interacting with, you know, kids who are going to school pretty much their entire lives, I would think.
Yeah. One of the things that we wanted, you know, my wife was never fully on board with the homeschooling thing until a few years into it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You
know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And unschooling in particular. So, you know, one of the ways that helped her get her head around trying this out was to swinging door between the home and our school. If the kids want to go, they have a good reason wanting to go, we'll let them. But I just want to be clear that they could always come out. And so she agreed with that, because the main thing that we want to do with our children. And this is one of the things that school really, I mean, one of the things that really bothers me about school is that it just enforces conformity.
Sure.
It, you know, I mean, you know, you go along to get along, you know, and school really teaches you that, you know, they say you have a choice of, but the choice is, do I do my homework or do I go to detention? Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, you know, these aren't really great choices.
Right.
But we wanted to make sure our children had choices and got good at them, because how many people, like, you know, when I see all this stuff about helicopter parenting and kids, you know, with all this anxiety, it's just like, why is making choices so threatful for kids today? It's just like, so we felt, although our main rationale for doing it is that we wanted our kids to get good at making choices. The only way they're going to get good is to make a bunch of choices, and some of them will be bad and they'll realize that and so on. So we want to keep it as safe as possible, but really make them real choices. So when they said, want to go to school, we let them. My oldest daughter wanted to try school out. And when we did get started, now see, I am lucky, because at Holt Associates, I was the boss, and John always had volunteers bring their children to the office. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So we had no problem bringing our children to the office and inviting our other employees to bring their children to the office. So we sort of made a little community just in the office, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that spread out as volunteers, and our kids met other kids and eventually met other homeschoolers. And yeah, by the mid-90s, there were enough homeschoolers in our group that we were putting on plays and renting out theaters. And, you know, we had maybe 60 families involved in those projects. So it did scale up naturally over time, but we never wanted our children. And to this day, I really find that it was very valuable for us. Not to say, oh, you don't want to talk to those kids in school because it's going to make you want to go to school.
Sure. You know? Right.
And I know, and I understand that a lot of parents feel that way, but you know what? a lot of those kids who were in school, their parents want them talking to us because then they're asking their parents to homeschool them.
Right. I think the other thing, too, is the kind of otherizing, right? Like, oh, those school kids, it's not just that they're going to make school look enticing. They're also might be like, well, that's not a good influence. Like, I worry about people setting that up for children as well. Like, just the importance of avoiding the adversarial relationship with school in the minds. I mean, we can have whatever kinds of attitudes about school we want, but the importance of, and I think this is what you're speaking to, not setting up that adversarial relationship with school in the mind of a child, right?
That's right. That's right. That's absolutely right. And, you know, because a lot of that is our own baggage. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I certainly have bad school experiences that I carry with me, but I don't want that to go on my children. And I'm really lucky that, you know, my oldest daughter, she wanted to try sixth grade, you know, because her best friend who is our next door neighbor, you know, was going to school, and she and Heather wanted to do a science project together, and she thought it was going to be this great experience. And after she did it, she said, "Get me out of here." You know, and so sixth grade was it, and then she homeschooled right through high school. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to my youngest daughter, she was, because I'm looking out the window. I'm on the third floor of my house. I could see what used to be the public schools just right around the corner from our house. Mm. Now it's an administrative building for Tufts University. So my kids always knew. We saw the parade of buses and people coming in here every day, you know. And Audrey wanted to try it. So first grade, she goes in, and within the second week, the teacher, her teacher, Miss wonderful lady, I can't remember her name, Miss Rapucci, she called my wife and I and said, "You know, your daughter Audrey knows how to count up to 100. She's spelling her name. She knows the alphabet, and she's a very talkative, active child. And there's a lot of kids here who aren't up to that yet. And I really can't give her the attention she wants. She might be better off being homeschooled." And she said that with Audrey present, you know. And so that really made a difference. So Audrey had no problem. Okay, I'll go back to homeschooling. So that was an interesting thing encounter. And she unfortunately passed away. And then in third grade, Audrey wanted to try it. Okay, so she goes in, and within a week, she and the teacher were butting heads and got so bad. We finally got a phone call from the principal, and the principal, who of course knows us and the family situation, said, "We're calling you because Audrey asked me to call you to see if she could be homeschooled again."
Right. So this is how many times in and out by age?
That's twice now.
Okay. Yep.
She did one more time.
Okay.
She did one more time where she went in and out of fifth grade, you know, for a year. And then that was it. And so, you know, and so when people think that, oh, it's either or, this is what I keep telling. It doesn't have to be either or. You know, there's, you know, you have the right to pull them in and out, and schools know this, and especially if they know you're homeschooling them, that you're not like forcing them to work in a field somewhere, which is against the law. it worked, and it worked for us, and I think it could work for more. But yeah, this idea that we must be separate from the schoolers, and that we're not in the same boat, and there's, you know, never the twain shall meet. I don't agree with that at all. I think that we really, really need to give our kids, you know, the strength to make choices and to see why going to school may be a good choice at some point. If they wanted, you know, my daughter wanted to be a social worker. She couldn't get a license without going to a social work program. So she did a graduate program in it, you know. Now, unfortunately, she's not a social worker anymore. She burned out at that, and she's a yoga instructor, which costs a lot less to get certified in. But that's another story.
So how did your close contact with the ideas of John Holt inform your creation of a homeschooling environment? Again, a big question. Three kids over, you know, a period of 12, 15 years each, sure.
Right.
But I'm sure there were some things about, you know, his message that were really, really impactful that were sort of ever-present in that environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that really is remarkable to me is that you have to have time. And we don't have a lot of time. We are, you know, the technology and the rush, the go, go, go attitude that you know, we have here in America in particular, but most industrial societies, you know, we're on this conveyor belt of progress, and we must keep making money and keep building things and never stop, blah, 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 blah. Well, one of the things that I learned is that homeschooling gives you the opportunity to stop.
Yeah.
to take stock, you know, I mean, and this was really hard for my wife to get involved in, to understand, because she was in the military. Her dad was served in Vietnam. He was a colonel. You know, I mean, you know, she had a real regimented life, and she lived all around the world traveling. So she was always used to, you know, having schedules and being places and stuff and that other people have determined for you.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, sure.
And it's like all of a sudden, the five of us are home, and we can make our own schedule. They could come to work with me and my wife, or I could work at home when my wife goes to the office that day, or I could just if I'm able to, I could take the time off and just For instance, one of the I've always had a hobby of doing magic, and my youngest child wanted to have a magic club. She went through a period where she was really into it, and she was getting pretty good with sleight of hand. So for 3 years, we ran the stage and parlor magic club in my house, and it got so big. At one point, we had 20 children coming here. It was a gas, and I loved it. And to this day, I bump into some of them when they're grown, and they tell me about, you know, they still remember how much fun we had and stuff. You know, as we go around and we perform for, you know, the homeschoolers fairs and old folks homes and stuff. It was, you know, and again, but that just took time. It wasn't like, oh, what do you want to do today? Oh, let's do a magic club, Dad. You know, I mean, and that's when you realize. And then reading. It's like, you know, my wife was always worried about reading. And so in one of his books, I think it's Learning All the Time, John talks about using, you know, just post-it notes to make flashcards. Again, you don't need – I mean, you could spend thousands of dollars on these phonics curriculums and stuff, you know. But really, it's not necessary, you know. So using post-it notes as flashcards, our oldest daughter learned to read by third grade just like you're supposed to. Our second daughter, she couldn't learn to read that way because she had meningitis as a child. And so she, you know, the look-say method was the only thing that worked for her, because speaking phonically was very difficult for her. She had some apraxia from her meningitis. So the look-say method. And so my wife, and so I'm saying to my wife, see, John Holt is right. I mean, children learn in a variety of ways. It's not just whole language or phonics. It's sort of a blend, and you got to be flexible with all this stuff. And you know what was going on this whole time? Our daughter Audrey was teaching herself to read. She was picking it up from being read to by us and her sisters. Because really, all of a sudden, she was five and she was reading independently. And my wife were like, did you teach her? I didn't do anything. So, you know, I saw it with my own eyes. You know, it's like, you know, this rigidity of education. Oh, it must be whole language, or it must all be phonics, and it must follow this certain type of pattern, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and sure enough, there's a child that taught herself. You know, and you know, when I look back, I mean, I taught myself how to play the piano.
Yeah,
I got a lot better when I took lessons as an adult. But that does, you know, I think maybe if I had lessons earlier, it would have ruined my enjoyment of the piano, and I wouldn't have taken lessons later. You know,
which one of your girls learned to read from Legend of Zelda?
Oh, that was my middle daughter, the one who had the apraxia.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But, you know, she was always asking me to read the captions, and one day I just said, "I don't have the time." So she just put her mind to it and figured it out.
That's a very cool story. You know, you talked about being able to slow down, right? And this was one of the things that really drove me to look for something else, some other kind of way of learning, because I believed when I was certainly getting disheartened and certainly growing very skeptical of school when I was doing this work as a teacher and a tutor. But by 2006, I'm watching these kids that are told they're achieving, that are told they're smart, that are told they're on a path to success. And every half hour of their lives were entirely managed for them by somebody else, right? Through the school day to extracurricular activities to you have Brett the tutor from 3 to 5, and then you'll do homework from 5 to 7:30, and then you'll eat dinner. And it was like the removal of all choice from their lives.
That's right.
And I started to see it as, you know, not only heartbreaking, but kind of a scary thing, right? That people were growing accustomed to a life without choice, right? And,
yes.
when do they train themselves, or how do they train themselves out of that as adults, or do they ever do it? And, you know, the cost for me when this kind of forced me to reflect on my own experience as a student, even though I was certainly not an overachiever, but a lot of my life and a lot of my time was very managed, you know, by school and by parents. I didn't know much about myself, right? When I'm making this huge investment in college and, you know, deciding what I'm going to do with my life, I didn't have a lot of self-knowledge. I had never been invited to engage in a process of conscious living, you know, the kind of thing that actually leads to self-knowledge. And I think that, you know, the stories that I've heard about people who embrace unschooling, and, you know, Sandra Dodd was just talking about the volume of choices that exist in that kind of world from moment to moment is what opens up the opportunity for people to know themselves from a very mm-hmm. early age.
Yeah, having that time. There is my friend Milva McDonald and Sophia Sage are pushing slow homeschooling.
Mm.
They're picking it up from, you know, the years ago there was a slow cooking movement and slow eating movement, and they're saying slow homeschooling. We got to all slow down here.
What are the principles of slow homeschooling?
Well, one of the things that they do is they organize local groups to get together, and the only thing is that, and I hope I'm getting this right. When you join the group, you have to commit to wanting to put on an event or do something, you know, mm-hmm. for the group, and suggest what that would be, and then talk it out. So it's more of a that's in a group. And then when you read Milva's blog, I mean, she's talking about just let the kids read all day, let them relax, you know, take it slow. You know, yeah, you've got things to do later in the day, so take a slow morning. Then you're gonna have a hectic afternoon, you know, because some homeschooling families are, you know, they might as well be in school the way they're so. They're so uptight and pushing and going because, you know, they feel like, you know, again, like, you know, this idea that you're not learning unless you're producing something that can be judged, you know, but you can't look in someone's head and see how much knowledge they're getting. You know, even standardized tests we know aren't showing that. It's all a weird game we play to think that we can figure out who the smartest is by just giving them a test score,
right?
You know? So slow homeschooling is I think an idea that will slowly take place. I mean, take hold, I hope, you know. But again, like you were making the point about how the need for education is so ingrained in people, you know, that they willingly, you know, forget. I mean, willingly submit to all these requirements to take courses or you know, pay this, you know, this fee to get the certification, you know. We have to step back. It's like when is all that gonna change? Because that's not serving us, you know. That's serving the bureaucracy, you know, of whoever is the permitter.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So one of the things that I really enjoy about, you know, being part of the alternative home world of education and homeschooling and unschooling in particular is how people are finding, you know, we're not trying. I don't think you're going to be able to rebuild the schools or fix them from within. You know, I think that, you know, we just need to show other options and let people gradually move towards them. I was just recently talking to a friend about, you know, she wanted, you know, to abolish compulsory school laws, thinking that, oh, that'll solve so many problems getting rid of them. And, you know, I really pushed back on her because she thought John Holt, you know, because she was reading selectively from like Escape from Childhood and mm-hmm. Freedom and Beyond, where he's taught. Yeah. John always says compulsory school laws are the worst thing that we've ever come up with for children and blah, blah, blah. But he also changed his opinion about them very early. And by the 1976, the New York Times asked him to write an article about abolishing compulsory school laws. And he said he wouldn't because it makes no sense. He said, I'll write an article about how we've internalized the need for education, that you could abolish compulsory school laws and everyone's still going to send their kids to school.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that, you know. I mean, you don't have to go to school after 16. You don't have to go to school before 5. There's a rush to do it. And in fact, you know, in Teach Your Own, John pointed out that I think it was Mississippi or Missouri didn't even have compulsory school laws, was they didn't want to receive federal funds that would then force them to segregate the schools and so on. But they still were able to maintain, they had state laws and people had no problem sending their kids to school then, you know, and filling them. So, you know, we really have internalized this need for school and more importantly, the need to buy education, you know? I mean, whereas, you know, Brian Ray is a homeschool researcher, and for years he's been, you know, studying how much families spend on homeschooling. And I believe the number now is up to $600. The average is $600 per child per year.
Yeah.
You know, and that's because, you know, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, we're looking for experiences for our children. We're looking for other people and other things for them to do. And very often that involves public facilities or facilities that friends and you share. I mean, the Commonwealth. I love that Commonwealth idea, you know, and unschoolers and homeschoolers are developing an educational Commonwealth. I mean, we all know who the, you know, the friendly librarians are and, you know, what, you know, which farms, you know, let you, you pick them, you know, bring your kids during school hours and, you know, to pick fruit and do stuff, you know. I mean, there's a, you know, that wasn't a good example, but, you know, there's a network that that people share. And sometimes it's – most of the time it's informal, you know.
Right. Have you seen – I'd be – because you did this like through the growth of the age of information as an unschooling family.
Yes.
Did you ever see the cost go down? Like I would think as people could network better, as people could pool their resources, as information became more freely available and you didn't need to send away for VHSs and stuff
right.
like that, that you would actually see like, oh, wow, we are saving money, you know, here in 1998 compared to what
right.
we were doing in 1993.
Right. Well, you know, the problem is the internet costs money.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, funny you say this because I was just talking about, you know, cord cutting the other night. I mean, we're looking at our cable bill. I mean, when we started, I think in the 90s was $49.99 for a triple play package.
Yep.
Now it's like $200 a month once you add on all the fees and additional charges.
Sure.
You know? So, I mean, those costs and you know, there used to be – I mean, there still are a lot of inexpensive opportunities But yeah, Brett, your point is really interesting. Why hasn't the cost gone down even more? You know, it's interesting. I'll never forget. I was at a conference in Washington, D.C. in the mid-90s, and this man, his name was Ed Doerr, D-O-E-R, I think is how, or two R's. And he was representing a teacher's union. And he was very nice, you know, but you know, he got up and just pointed out, oh, homeschooling is, you know, just not scalable. It can't work. And his example was, they're not going to be able to get the discounts that schools get on textbooks and food. And you know, and again, like he was thinking, and I couldn't quite get my response to address it because, I mean, he was coming at it like, you know, in order to be legit, we had to fully replace the schools.
With economies of scale and all that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and so I was trying to, you know, point out that it's, you know, the scale, our scale time frame is a lot longer than yours. And I don't want people to be forced into homeschooling the way you force them into in school. I want people to come to it, you know, because it makes sense and it works for them. It's just an option, you know. I mean, it's not meant to be a school, a compulsory
right,
school.
Right.
And then sure enough, like within, I don't know, 3 or 4 years after that conference in the late 90s, some guy had opened the homeschool discount warehouse where like he was using the power of the internet to get huge discounts on textbooks and food and all these other things for homeschoolers.
Mm-hmm.
So even there, you know, I mean, it's an example of how technology could help. But I've still, you know, I think a lot of people think that homeschooling is expensive because of the time of losing a salary of the two income family.
Sure.
You know, and then they get put off. Like when you read like, what's his name? Elon, Musk and you know, the Tesla guy, you know, he got some publicity a couple of years ago because he claimed to have created an unschooling school that costs $40,000 a year.
You know? Sure. And couple that with the fact that, you know, in a lot of the good public school districts, they're, you know, raking in $20,000 a year per student, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if people equate school with education or, you know, school with learning and they see that price tag on it, that could be pretty intimidating, I think, as well.
Right.
So right. I wanted to – you have time for one more question. I want to be respectful
sure.
of your time. All right, because it kind of leads into, you know, you talking about outreach or getting these ideas to more people. And I think about this a lot. So with John Holt, GWS, right, .com,
yes.
which is now sort of the form of the magazine, right?
All the issues of the magazine are up there.
Are there now. So obviously you guys have had conversations like, how do we get more eyes in front of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing the same project for the last year with SchoolSucksProject.com. And, you know, if you have a website about like, here's how you get in shape, or this is a website about makeup, or this is a website about meeting women, or this is a website about, you know, a business opportunity – most of these endeavors have a pretty straightforward formula as far as the keywords you should use to attract attention. And I said, well, this should be pretty easy to figure out how to get more eyes on SchoolSucksProject.com. Then this debate begins about homeschooling, unschooling, deschooling.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little bit discouraging to see what the search volumes for some of these things were, like how low. they were. But also, you know, I went through this really idealistic phase with what I was doing. It was like, we're not going to say unschooling because it has school in it. And, you know, I still think, I think the person who first taught me this was Laurette Lynn. Who's
I know her. I think I did a podcast with her.
Yeah, and she's great. And she said to me, you know, only school can do school. So take school out. And I like that, right? So I stuck to that. But then I said, well, if I'm calling this home education and people are searching for unschooling, there's an unbuilt bridge between, you know, what I have and that need or that investigation that people are doing. So I've had to figure out compromises that I can make to attract more people to what we're doing. But because, you know, you first encountered this work now almost 40 years ago, right? In the early 80s.
That's right.
And you've accrued a lot of wisdom in that time. I wanted to get your thoughts on some of the language that we use. Words like unschooling and deschooling, but also the word education and educator, those terms. So why don't we start with unschooling? How do you feel about that term?
Well, I feel uncomfortable in general because unschooling, especially in the last 15 years, has gone through this weird phase where you go to a conference and people would say, what do you mean by unschooling?
Right.
And that always bothered me. It's like, wait, for me, it was very simple because, and it still is. All right. I understand why people, definitions change, no doubt, but the original definition of unschooling is one I always go with. And that is what John Holt wrote, which is unschooling is, he preferred the word over homeschooling because it refers to learning that doesn't have to take place at home and it doesn't have to look like school. Simple, plain, straightforward, and does make a distinction between school and what he's proposing. But it's gotten so confused, you know, what people means, you know, because then it gets into this thing. And I remember going through this with the National Coalition of Alternative Community Schools in the mid-80s when they were getting more and more accepting of homeschoolers. And but they had this whole issue of coercion. You know?
Yeah.
And, I don't know. I mean, you know, parents could be much more coercive than alternative educators. And I was like, I don't know about that. And then everyone gets, you know, this whole idea of coercion then became like, you know, are you coercing your child because, you know, you're asking them to stay, you know, to stay here while you go to the bathroom?
You know? Right, right.
It became these really weird thought experiments, or sometimes they're actual incidents. And I was like, okay, but, you know, I don't mind that, you know, I think we have to have the big tent of unschooling, or in homeschooling is probably the word, because even John Holt stopped using the word unschooling when, you know, when he just realized that, just like he gave up, didn't give up, but said he changed tack. And when children's rights didn't work, it didn't mean he didn't think children shouldn't have rights anymore. He says, I'm just ahead of the curve here. These people are not, it's not getting traction. What will get traction? His next book was Freedom and Beyond, where he tried the alternative schools. But he even talked himself out of that by the end of that book. He said, it's still not enough. You know, alternative schools are still soft jails instead of hard jails, but they're not what I'm talking about. And then instead of education, he called for the Underground Railroad to get children out of compulsory schools. And that's where he learned about homeschooling, and a year later started Growing Without Schooling. And then the word homeschooling bothered him so much, he came up with the word unschooling. And by the way, that's because he actually, I think the second issue makes a distinction between deschooling, unschooling, and homeschooling, which is all like, you know, academic at this point. But And I spoke, and Ivan Illich often tells the story too, that he didn't like the word deschooling. He didn't even come up with the title. It was his editor that came up with the title.
And it was a reference to society, right? As the title, like deschooling society, which is a bigger idea. You know, today it's sort of used on an individual level, like when a child wants to be free of public school or institutionalized school, and there has to be a kind of deschooling process. That's the most common usage of it today. So just a period of basically decompression and resetting after being removed from the expectations and the schedule of a public school.
That's right. And that has been very consistent. I've even heard, you know, a rule of thumb from the 80s, which I think is still true. For every year your child has been in school, it's going to take a month to de-school them out of it. Just leave them be they got to get all that BS of what's expected of them, you know, Now that they're home, it's a different story, but they don't trust it. So they have to be de-schooled. So, yeah, so you got de-schooling, unschooling. And John, of course, John Holt was always on about self-directed learning, even in How Children Learn, which came out in 68. I mean, you saw 67 or 68. He was talking about watching babies and infants and young toddlers. And this is self-directed learning. Mm-hmm. You know, and now, you know, and then he didn't use the phrase, but in the 80s, the phrase would sometimes come up, personalized learning, you know. And now all of them have been co-opted by the schools. Self-directed yes. learning means choosing a computer program, you know, or an app. Personalized learning means sitting down with someone at a computer and either having a live or a video recording, you know. Mm-hmm. It's personalized because you made the mandatory selection from your prepackaged choices.
Right.
But I mean, that's hardly a real choice in my estimation.
No, I just remember like the deliberation, like sitting there in front of this Google keyword tool going, okay, self-directed education or self-directed learning, you know, and this was just a process of trying to decide after, you know, not homeschooling, not unschooling. We like deschooling, but the search volume is low. It was a frustrating experience on many levels.
But homeschooling probably had a high search volume.
Homeschooling, yeah, but it's not, you know, specific enough, right? And it can there are a lot of people who would be searching for homeschooling who would come to my website, search around it for 5 minutes and be horrified, you know? And I don't – and that was another part of this decision-making process is I don't want to be drawing in people who are going to be disappointed or are going to bounce off the site right away. So trying to find this like magic keyword formula that was going to bring the right people to us. Now I kind of moved away from that idea and just like building a new site and saying like, look, this is very clearly who we are and what we do. And if it's for you, welcome. And if it's not, good luck. And so that's where I'm working today. One more question about unschooling though. Mm-hmm. Didn't unschooling – I mean, isn't that a very, very like hundreds of years old term that
Absolutely.
Originally meant somebody with a natural ability or like a natural, right?
Yes, that's right.
This I actually like. I like this.
Right.
It's like somebody would be an unschooled musician, meaning
exactly.
that they had an ability to do it without having it forced on them in a certain
that's
way.
That's right. So that's right.
One more etymological question, and we can end with this. It's one of my favorite things I've ever heard you discuss. The word education, the story of the word education.
Mm-hmm. And again, this arose from a conversation with Ivan Illich. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes, you know, I'm pretty sure he wrote this down too in a book. But for me, you know, when you meet with educators, they always say, you know, they're the leader. Because that's what educate means. It means to lead forth, you know, and I'm going to take I'm going to take the substance that I find in you and draw it out. There's always this idea of them doing something to you. And then Illich pointed out to me that the Latin root is educare, and that means to nourish, specifically to nourish through breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, you know, in the early church iconography, you will often see statues or paintings where the head of the monastery or the saint that's praying has breasts. It's the milk of knowledge. I would love to find one of these icons, by the way. Illich did mention them. He said that they're around, but I've yet to find a good photo to support that. But anyway, what educare means is, it means to pull forth, but it means the child is pulling out the milk from the mother. The child is getting the knowledge from the parent. It's not the parent giving it to them. It's a child drawing it forth. It's a mutual nurturing relationship. It's not this dominator subject relationship, master pupil.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so the idea that the child is the active, again, it goes right, you know, it ties in so well with John Holt's ideas that it's the activity of the learner, you know, it's the act of breastfeeding that gives nourishment. It's not, you know, and the child has to participate in that. They can't be an unwilling participant, you know, and I guess the old days, they always had that idea of knowledge, that knowledge is something that you sought from somebody and that, you know, you gained from them. It wasn't something they pulled out of you, something you pulled out of them.
Right. Yeah. Sandra, who I just talked to last week, she was saying, I'm not crazy about that word because, number one, it makes it kind of the noun, right? An education. It's
right.
finite. It's something that
right.
you go and get, but somebody already has it to give it to you, right? So, right. So what's happened in the co-opting of it is it goes from active learning, what you're describing, to being a kind of dispensary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem. That's losing its meaning. So
right.
I remember hearing you tell that story, and I just loved it. Mm-hmm. I forgot. I don't know how I forgot the most shocking part of it, that of the church iconography. but yeah, I'd be interested in seeing that as well.
Right?
Yeah. So we just plucked a handful of things out of a long outline that I wrote. So I hope I could have you back sometime in the future for another conversation. I really, really enjoyed talking to you, as I knew that I would. I hope we can do a part two sometime in the near future.
We certainly can. I enjoyed speaking with you too, Brett.
Can you just tell people in my audience, if they're interested in finding more of your work or your projects, where they can go?
Sure. The website is www.johnholtgws.com. GWS stands for the magazine John started in 1977 called Growing Without Schooling. And when he passed away, I continued publishing it for another 16 years until 2001. So it's got over 143 issues, over 6,000 pages of the history and development of homeschooling and unschooling in particular.
Awesome.
A lot of info there. Yep.
I'll make sure it's linked in the show notes. There's lots of free resources there as well. So, Pat, thanks again. I look forward to our next conversation.
Same here, Brett. Pleasure to meet you. To end my life.